available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and a warm welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, which we're recording on Wednesday, the 3rd of December 2025. And coming up in this edition, Elaine is going to go to Packington. We're going to find out from Lee Child how he created Jack Reacher. We're going to also learn about canine hair eyes, how they can be taught to sniff out horrible things like diseases. Lane also asked why watching TV is such hard work nowadays. Martin, the tractor driver, you may remember, those who won't go to the Monday Club, had his tractor here in the car park earlier, and he's going to tell us about his tour around Coventry and Warwickshire on the 12th and 13th of December. And before we go, there will be the answers to your quizzes, your quiz last week, which was put to you by Sarah, but there's also news from the Hub, Sport and your postbag. But as ever, we're going to start with this week's news with Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Six key announcements for state pensioners in the Labour Party autumn budget have been unveiled. The Department for Work and Pensions state pensioners have received assurances that the Labour government remains dedicated to the triple lock. The Chancellor confirmed that the state pension will climb 4.8% for the 2026-27 financial year, as dictated by the triple lock mechanism. The full new state pension will grow by approximately £570 annually, she stated, for individuals who reach the state pension age after April 6, 2016. Those who retired beforehand on the full basic state pension will receive a smaller rise. The six important announcements were 1. State pension. As described, a 4.8% increase next April for full state pension. Generally, you require 35 years of qualifying contributions to secure a full state pension. This brings the state pension nearer to being liable for income tax, a matter of considerable debate. It will also rekindle discussions regarding the fairness of the so-called triple lock. 2. Pension credit. Pension credit is also set to increase next April. More than three-quarters of pensioners in England and Wales will receive a winter fuel payment this winter. 3. Triple lock. A positive commitment to the triple lock, meaning that the state pension is set to increase by more than inflation next April. 4. National insurance. Ms Reeves announced a major shake-up to the state pension system, with thousands of retirees living overseas expected to pay more to be able to access their full payment entitlement. Number 5. Cash ISA. The amount you can save in a tax-free cash ISA has been slashed from £20,000 to £12,000 in the budget. The cut will come into effect from April 2027, but it will not affect over-65s, who will be allowed to stick to the £20,000 limit. And the sixth one, private pension pots. Salary-sacrificed pension contributions above £2,000 a year will no longer be exempt from national insurance from April 2029, the Chancellor announced. That won't matter much for those who make around £40,000 a year and pay 5% of their salary into their pension pot. But for higher earners, the impact is greater.
Four councils in Warwickshire have formally submitted a proposal to create two unitary authorities for the county. The plan, backed by Nuneaton and Bedworth, North Warwickshire, Warwick and Stratford-on-Avon councils, would replace the county's six authorities with one in the north and one in the south. The four councils said this would provide a balanced, future-facing model which was simple, strong and sustainable. It came, though, after Warwickshire County Council and Rugby Borough Council in October backed a proposal for a single unitary authority, a new super council, to cover the entire county. But Warwick District Council leader Ian Davison said that the North-South plan, which they submitted to the government on Thursday, would deliver the best outcome for residents. The two unitary model, he said, respects the real identities between North and South Warwickshire, while ensuring that both areas have the scale, resilience and strategic capacity to deliver excellent services. Currently, the council is run via a two-tier local authority system, with Warwickshire County Council as the upper tier, Warwick, Rugby, Nuneaton and Bedworth, North Warwickshire and Stratford-on-Avon making up the lower tier. In February, the government told all councils in two-tier areas to submit proposals for a move to a unitary system as part of local government reorganisation plans. It would mean one council being held responsible for all local authority services in each area, including planning, rubbish and recycling collections, libraries and education.
The BBC licence fee is forecast to surge towards £200, whilst the number of households paying is set to tumble by almost 5%. Official estimates from the Office for Budget Responsibility suggest that the annual cost, presently £174.50, could climb to nearly £197 by the decade's end, should it continue tracking inflation rates. At the same time, the total of fee payers is projected to drop by more than 1 million, falling to roughly 21 million, as viewers migrate to streaming giants like Netflix, Amazon Prime and Disney Plus. This predicament has been worsened by rising evasion and cancellations. The corporation endured losses exceeding 1 billion last year as households either ditched the charge or flatly declined to pay. A further 300,000 ceased payments in 2024 alone. Research by the Public Accounts Committee found that 3.6 million households now claim they have no need for a TV licence whatsoever. Whilst one in eight users are believed to be actively avoiding payment despite accessing BBC content. These statistics emerge as the BBC begins crucial talks about its future financing model, with its Royal Charter due to expire in 2027. Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy has signalled her readiness to take a radical approach when reviewing the existing framework and has pledged to consider all potential alternatives. She insists that funding must remain sustainable, but is contemplating whether to halt a nearly £7 increase scheduled for spring, an almost 4% rise, in light of the strain on household budgets. Government ministers have intervened before. In 2022, the Conservative government froze the fee for 2 years. The BBC's licence fee income had dropped by 30% in real terms between 2010 and 2020, due to ongoing financial restrictions.
Concerns about the structural integrity of a historic Coventry building have been raised. 14 and 15 Spon Street, also known as Tudor House, is a building believed to date back as far as the 15th century and was once home to the Recruiting Sergeant pub. The Grade 2 listed building, owned by Coventry City Council with Historic England, has been dormant for several years, having previously been utilised for commercial and office use in its post-pub era. But extensive water damage to a rear wall has led to an impact on the building's structural integrity, according to a planning application seeking to demolish and rebuild the wall in question. An application submitted by architects to the council's planning portal states, "The current building has been vacant for a number of years. The frontage is in good condition, with the gable bays from the 70s and 80s still intact. The rear, however, is in a poor condition. It has suffered from water ingress over the years, which has resulted in structural instability of the rear elevation. This water ingress is evident on the first floor and ground floor, which has resulted in damage to the fabric and structure of the property. The first floor has damage to the external brickwork wall, to the window frames and to the flooring. The ground floor has suffered more damage, as the water has caused rot to the windows and water from the first floor has come through to below, damaging the lath and plaster ceiling in the process. The integrity of the brickwork wall has been compromised, and bowing is evident in this section of the wall. The external joinery, that is, skirting boards and picture rails, have also been damaged by water, and this is the cause of the movement in the back of the building, which weakens the integrity of the wall structure. Thus, the application seeks to demolish a section of the rear wall of the property due to the water and structural damage that has occurred, and to rebuild the wall with new, like-for-like windows to preserve the building for the future. The Recruiting Sergeant pub first opened in the early 1800s and is thought potentially to have taken its name from the nearby Army Barracks on Smithford Street. It initially took up number 15 Spond Street, but after the First World War took over number 14 as well, before closing in the late 1920s. The building has had a series of uses ever since, most recently as a picture framer's called City Arts. Despite much of Spond Street being part of a rebuild project off the back of the Coventry Ring Road, it is understood that Tudor House has been in that same location as far back as the 1400s.
A low-carbon heating system using waste heat from a city incinerator is likely to be expanded. Heatline takes hot gases from the London Road Energy from Waste facility in Coventry and delivers it via underground pipes to 9 buildings in the city centre, including the Council House, Coventry Cathedral and the Wave Water Complex. A report to the City Council recommended the contract with the firm running the scheme should be extended to 2043, so it can offer new customers the service at a commercially viable rate. The meeting heard the overall revenues had been less than expected, while costs had been higher. The original network cost about £5.6 million, which was paid for using £2.2 million of a Homes and Communities Agency grant and the Coventry District Energy Company. The network has already been expanded at a cost of about £3.6 million. The report said the relatively low customer base was an underlying factor for the financial performance, and added that increasing the numbers of customers using the network would help address that. 11 Coventry University buildings are being connected to the network, due to be fully completed in 2026, something which, the meeting was told, would prompt a significant increase in the revenue, without affecting the fixed costs of the network. Funding has also been secured to connect the city's two court buildings, which are hoped to be completed by 2028. A further 18 buildings could also be connected to the network, but a contract extension would be needed to maximise grant support for this.
Figures issued by Coventry Council this week show that there were 1,121 missing children incidents reported in the city in 2024. The data was released by the council through a Freedom of Information request. But the 1,121 statistic relates to just 366 children, many being reported missing multiple times. The data, taken from the period from the 1st of Jan to the 31st of December last year, also shows markers were put alongside these cases, with 352 relating to risk of exploitation and 269 being marked mental health issues. Coventry City Council's definition of a missing child is any child or young person under the age of 18 whose whereabouts cannot be established and not at a place where they are expected or required to be. When a child is reported missing and is subsequently found, a return home interview is the usual procedure. According to the council's response, 710 of these meetings were completed in 2024, with less than 5 of them resulting in harm risk markers being applied. The actual figure and the nature of the risks cannot be released in the interests of confidentiality. Importantly, West Midlands Police state that you do not have to wait 24 hours to report someone missing. If you think a person is in danger, you can report them missing right away. And if the missing person is in immediate danger, is a young child, or is vulnerable to harm, you should call 999.
Flying taxis and drones could soon become part of everyday life in Coventry. Coventry City Council has started the Urban Ascent project, which will involve experts studying how drones can improve city services and speed up emergency and medical deliveries. The project will also set up a plan to ensure drones are introduced safely while transporting medicines and supplies for the NHS, delivering defibrillators, or even carrying out aerial road surveys. Councillor Jim O'Boyle said the plans would help Coventry take the next step in aligning technology with public needs, especially with preparations for urban air taxis. We are talking about things like drones being used to fly urgent medical supplies between hospitals, being used to inspect bridges and roads, and using them to enable an overview of things like road accidents and road congestion. The urban air taxis are part of a family of vehicles called eVTOLs, which stands for Electrical Vertical Takeoff and Landing Aircraft, and could be used to replace expensive journeys currently done by helicopters. Earlier this year, Coventry-based drone company Skyfarer teamed up with the University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire National Health Trust to see if radioactive medicine could be delivered to hospitals by drone. The Urban Ascent work is part of being funded by Innovate UK and the Department for Transport through the Future Flight Regional Demonstrator Programme, while also being led by the Council.
A Coventry pub has unveiled a major £300,000 makeover with an innovative concept people are already loving. The Penny Farthing in Bannerbrook Park, run by Marston's, has been completely transformed with a range of new upgrades. Pubgoers can now enjoy a newly redesigned bar with Sky Sports and a separate family lounge. Dogs are also welcomed into the community-oriented setting. Regulars can enjoy their favourite dishes alongside a special new menu and are invited to make Christmas bookings. Vegan and gluten-free options are also included in the revamped offering. Jack Rawlinson was invited to raise the first glass to mark the reopening. He was selected by members of a local Facebook group who say that he is a friendly face around the neighbourhood. Jack is frequently seen litter picking in the area and receives complimentary refreshments for his efforts. Pub manager Ian Weller said, "We are delighted to reopen the doors of the Penny Farthing and welcome our wonderful guests back to see the results of our refurbishment. We've invested significantly to breathe new life into the pub and we're looking forward to creating even more great memories with our loyal customers."
Three people were arrested following the Coventry City away clash with Middlesbrough on Tuesday night last week. Police made the arrests at the Riverside Stadium. Officers were alerted to reports of disorder at the end of the Middlesbrough and Sky Blues match, when Middlesbrough were defeated 4-2 by Coventry City. Two 17-year-old boys and an 18-year-old man were arrested. All three have been accused of public order offences and the investigation is ongoing. Two of the suspects were bailed and the third is set to voluntarily reattend for questioning. Officers are collaborating with Middlesbrough FC to strengthen security protocols for future games at the Riverside Stadium. A spokesman for Cleveland Police said, "One 18-year-old man and two 17-year-old boys were arrested for public order offences at the end of the Middlesbrough v Coventry match, and two more people are to be reported for summons. Incidents took place inside the Riverside Stadium, and we will be working closely with Middlesbrough FC to investigate further and prevent these types of incidents from occurring."
Coventry Christmas Market arrived on the city centre's Broadgate last week, with thousands of revellers attending on Saturday to witness its opening with the vibrant Festival of Christmas. A Coventry Telegraph reporter said, "I avoided that initial opening in favour of attending a few days later. I was keen to see what was on offer and to treat my four children to their first festive foray of the year. I arrived just as the sun was going down on a mild Wednesday night. I found a quieter, chilled marketplace that I imagine was much more peaceful than it had been on the previous weekend, but still with all the trappings of that magical Christmas feel. Your favourite festive tunes, twinkling lights, smoke emanating from the market's two fire pits, the smell of sugar and charred meat, not to mention the various bars selling Christmassy drinks to warm the cockles, be it Irish coffees, hot toddies or mulled wines. For those living in the West Midlands and surrounding areas, I suppose Birmingham's German market is the kind of pinnacle for this sort of thing. The Coventry equivalent makes no actual mention of a German element, but nods to its inspiration from up the M6, with the sizzling Frankfurter hot dogs and huge steins of German beer. But that's where I felt the similarities ended. The Coventry version is an entirely different beast to its Brummy cousin, in the same way that the two cities are quite different. Coventry's market is smaller, understated, much less intimidating and busy, and more manageable. The Birmingham market snakes around and creates a sense of disorientation, not helped by the sheer number of people who flock there each year. Take these things as you will, I suppose. Some people will like the hugeness of the Birmingham one, where others will like the containment of the Broadgate one. The day I visited, the lights and music were doing their best to get everyone Christmassy. It's definitely nice seeing Broadgate being put to good use, and the huge Ferris wheel is genuinely pretty. If, like my wife and I, you're a family with children, you'll be well used to approaching this kind of occasion with one eye firmly on the purse strings. Taking your eye off the finances and letting kids run riot can see your pounds run down in a very few seconds. But I would recommend the market. It's definitely a festive sight to behold, with lots going on. Like anything of this nature, it's obviously a fantastic money spinner, so do be prepared to spend a bit of cash. But once you've got your goods, there are plenty of spots to lean and enjoy. The actual seating is quite limited. It won't keep you entertained for an entire day, perhaps not even for an entire afternoon, but it's definitely a fun way to spend a nice Christmassy hour or two.
6 in 10 Brits intend to be more price conscious this Christmas as the budget triggered an immediate drop in consumer confidence. A snap poll conducted in the 24 hours after Chancellor Rachel Reeves' statement revealed that shoppers are also reassessing how far their festive budget can stretch. Almost half, 48%, said they plan to use Black Friday to help manage festive spending, with 42% saying the budget had made them more likely to hunt down good deals. A study conducted before the Chancellor's announcement found that Brits are sceptical about Black Friday, with 66% calling it a con and 59% saying they don't believe most discounts are real. But shoppers are becoming more analytical, using tech to help with their purchases. Nearly a quarter use AI tools such as ChatGPT and Google Gemini to find and compare deals, track prices or plan festive budgets. Around 82% will also use AI tools to help with gift ideas. As Black Friday got underway, Currys reaffirmed its commitment to value through its Our Lowest Ever Price event, promising customers that they're getting the best possible deal. Ed Connolly, Chief Commercial Officer at Currys, said, "As customers digest the impact of the budget, we're seeing people think even more carefully about how to stretch their money, and that means hunting out genuine value. As our research found, price consciousness is up, and Black Friday becomes an even more important moment for customers actively seeking better deals."
McDonald's fans have cause for excitement as the popular fast food chain launched its newest menu items in branches nationwide. Taking cues from the notoriously grumpy Grinch, the restaurant's festive lineup brings fresh flavours, fun additions, and the much anticipated comeback of customer favourites. Whether you're a cheese lover, chocolate devotee, or partial to pickles, this year's Christmas collection has something for everyone's festive cravings. A McDonald's spokesperson said, "McDonald's is spreading festive cheer with a delicious mix of exciting new treats and returning fan favourites. This year's lineup is packed with merry burgers, delightful desserts, tasty sides and hot and cold drinks to make the season even jollier. The fast food giant is fully embracing the festive spirit, launching the Grinch meal priced at £9.09. The real showstopper, however, is the exclusive pair of mismatched Grinch and McDonald's socks that come with every meal. TikTok users are calling this the modern-day adult Happy Meal, as excitement grows around receiving the socks this Christmas season. Another exciting new addition is the Cheesy Chicken Stack Meal, priced at £8.99. A spokesman said, "It's stacked, it's indulgent, and it's here to steal the spotlight." The Big Tasty is also making a comeback for £7.99. Well, I think I know him from somewhere. Anyway, one user exclaimed, "The Christmas cheese dippers are always the best." Another remarked, "Cheese melt dippers aren't new, but they are unreal." For drinks, the chain has introduced the new Frozen Grinch Lemonade, which combines frozen lemonade with a vibrant melon green swirl. For those seeking something warm, there's the new coconut latte and coconut hot chocolate. For dessert lovers, the Mischief McFlurry, featuring Smarties, Christmas tree pieces and fruity strawberry sauce, is a must. For those who prefer a deeper flavour, the chocolate brownie McFlurry, or the chocolate McBrownie Flurry, offers a much more decadent chocolate experience. And before I lie down, the fast food behemoth is preparing for Grinchmas with the unveiling of the 2025 festive menu last Wednesday. But this limited edition will only be available for 6 weeks, so ensure you don't miss out.
No comment.
Outlook News.
And thanks to Elaine and Peter for the news there. Now, before we move on, we've got obviously lighting up and lighting down, which is 7:45 in the morning and 3:58 in the afternoon. But what I have got are a few bits of entertainment which you might be interested in. And these are for next week, not this week at all, because by the time you get this tape, you won't have time to book, will you? So firstly, let's have a go at that. Coventry Cathedral on the 11th of December, there's Ex Cathedra Christmas Music by Candlelight. And on the 12th of December at the Cathedral also, Christmas Choir featuring the Brass Band of Central England. And also again on the 13th of December, that's three consecutive days, Coventry Cathedral Chorus, Handel's Messiah by Candlelight. Now moving on to something a little lighter possibly, at the Charterhouse in Coventry, A Christmas Carol, Paul Nolan's one-man production of Dickens' timeless take, and that's on the 14th of December. Also on the 11th, going back to the 11th of December, is Kids Theatre, Santa's on His Sleigh, interactive Christmas show featuring Santa's virtual little helper, Head of Justice, played on screen by Justin Fletcher. That's on Tuesday to Thursday, the 11th of December. And that is at the Albany Theatre in Coventry. And finally, A Christmas Market, featuring unique designs by local makers on Saturday the 13th and Sunday the 14th at Fargo Village in Coventry. So, there's a little bit of entertainment. I hope next week I'll have some more with some pantomimes probably added as well to get some festive fun into the occasion. Right, Hugh, you're full of festive fun, aren't you?
I'm absolutely delighted with festive fun. I'm recovering from quite a lot of the last night in A&E, not on my behalf, but on behalf of my foster child. But anyway, it's fine. He's okay. He's fine, yes. Good. He was just bleeding an awful lot out of his ear. You know, you have to go and get these things sorted out.
Of course,
you know,
yes.
But anyway, he was okay.
Good, yes.
And also recovering a bit after the winter warmer last Saturday, which was... It was fantastic. We had loads and loads and loads of people. And I have to say, for the first time ever, you ate me out of house and home. I had nothing left apart from a bit of cake. cake at the end. In fact, before the end. So some people turned up and they were a bit disappointed because they did not have any pork and stuffing batches and they did not have any soup left. Anyway, so thank you to everybody who came and supported it. We've raised about £1,650 so far. Actually, we know that number is going to tick up a bit, particularly for the in terms of the winter raffle, of course, that we've got going on at the moment. As Joe describes it, we have a lovely, rather large hamper as the first prize. He's got a load of stuff in there. There's a lot of sweet treats and some bottles of naughtiness and various other things in there that are... So it's going to be a great first prize. So if you fancy a flutter, tickets are available here from the centre. They're £1 a pop, or five for... £5
for a fiver.
And you can have a whole book, and we'll be drawing that in 2 weeks
in here
in this very studio,
live-ish
and so we will draw the winners there. I mean, there are other prizes as well. There's Coventry Blaze tickets, some Coventry rugby tickets, a bottle of whiskey. It's a very good bottle of whiskey, actually, I have to say. A bottle of Prosecco that only just made it into the raffle prize. It might have made it out somewhere. A bottle of Prosecco and some chocolate liqueurs and everything. And we've got 1,000 tickets to sell, and if we can sell all of those, then that would be fantastic. So just a little reminder, we've got the celebrations, the festive celebrations coming up, and as usual, Coventry Vision Hub will be closed over the Christmas period. In fact, we're closed over a slightly longer period this time than last. So we will our last day of operation will be the 23rd, so we will, which is a Tuesday. We will not be open on Wednesday the 24th, Christmas Eve. We then have the whole of the Christmas period off. The 1st of January is a Thursday, which means that the normal first day, in the first working day back at work normally, is Friday the 2nd, but it's a bit of an orphan day, really. So I've decided unilaterally that we're having it off, because as you probably know, the staff...
You're the boss.
Because I'm the boss and I can. But also the staff here work extremely hard, and so just having that just few extra days of relaxation.
So on the Monday.
So we'll be back open again on the Monday, and with Monday Club, and everything should be back up and running right on the 5th, I think it is, of January. Apart from that, the groups are indulging in Christmas festivities as well. So there'll be a lot of things happening in each of the groups. Those of you who come to a lot of groups will be getting a lot of Christmas parties. I'm talking to you, Peter Smith, and it's no different. Different Peter. Yes, Pete gets a lot of them, but it's fine. We always joke about how many mince pies he can get down in a week. So then what else we got going on? Oh, that's it, really. I'm going to be Santa for the sensory tots. So these are the...
paint your beard white.
No. They give me a false one, thank goodness. But so these are for toddlers who've got visual and hearing impairments, and I go and I play Santa for them. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Where's that?
Well, it's going to be in Cowden, but it's for the sensory support team. So they have this little group there. So that's going to be fun, you know, so I get to be Santa again. And that, I think, you know, is quite
well,
it, really.
Tommy coming up, haven't you?
Yeah, so we've got Tommy coming up in the new year. I've mentioned it so many weeks.
Just remind people in case they've forgotten already.
Yes, in case you've forgotten already. But yes, so that's coming up. Oh, there's also, of course, the concert on the 11th of December, the Stoneleigh Ladies Choir at Stoneleigh Village Hall, not at the church, at the Village Hall, and they're raising money in aid of us and indeed of our compadres in Warwickshire Vision. So if you're going to that, I will see you there, because I shall be speaking, not singing.
Hooray. Oh, sorry.
I'm not a lady.
So that's it, is it?
That's it. It's definitely it this time.
Good, thank you, Hugh. And from news here at the Hub, to Sarah with her sports report.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely, lovely sports fans. And welcome to Sport with Sarah. Now, before I kick off, excuse the football pun, I'd just like to say a big hello to four people in particular that I had a great chat with yesterday at the Winter Warmer. Today is Sunday. Those people being Ali, Trevor, Robert and Margaret. Yes, hello Margaret, although you're a blue nose, I love you. Blue noses support Birmingham City. Anyway, moving on to football. The mighty Coventry City headed up north on Tuesday to take on Middlesbrough. Now, going into this match, it was a really tasty match-up because it was first versus second in the league. And then to make it more tempting, their current manager at that time was A.D. Bybash, who you may remember was our deputy right up to June of last year after he'd fallen out with Mark Robbins. Well, we were quite nervous, but we didn't have to worry because in the 10th minute, Ellis Sims sent that ball goalwards, City 1, Middlesbrough 0, followed by Liam Kitchen making it 2-0 within 14 minutes. We were in fairyland. Unfortunately, we let them score in the 37th minute. Oh, well, you can't have it always. Anyway, that's how it was at half time. 2-1 to City. And then Bobby Thomas scored an own goal really early in the second half, which made it 2-2 and a very tense second half, with both teams really scrapping out for those 3 points. And it really looked as if Middlesbrough were going to sneak it. But then, in the 84th minute, goal! Followed in the 85th minute, goal! Both to City, courtesy of Ellis Sims and Liam Kitchen, who both picked up their brace. And so it finished. Middlesbrough 2, Coventry City 4. Wow, wow, wow. Could it get any better? Well, oh, by the way, at that stage, we were top of the league by a clear 10 points, with 40 points and plus 30 goal difference. Well, on Saturday we could see this banana skin coming up a mile off. We got Charlton Athletic. Now, Charlton were only promoted last year. They came up through the playoffs from Division 1, beating Leighton Orient. And they'd lost their previous 3 matches, and they'd hemorrhaged 8 goals in their last 2. This is a banana skin waiting to happen. And so it proved, because in the 13th minute, they scored. And it got worse for City a few minutes later, when Milan van Avat was brought down inside the box. The Charlton player had one hand on his back and one hand on his shoulder and sort of pushed and brought him down. And yet the referee, who was clearly wearing a Charlton kit under his black outfit, waved the penalty appeal away. I don't know. Fortunately, about halfway through this first half, Josh Eccles was on the end of a lovely pass from Ephraim Mason-Clark, the latter having dribbled it past 2 of the Charlton defenders, who just seemed to stand there wondering what had happened. And Josh Eccles sent that ball into that there goal. Whew! 1-1. That is a heck of a lot better than being 1-0 down at home. But then, in the 44th minute, Victor Torp had a corner which he sent powering its way straight towards Ellis Sims, who put it in at their goal. And so at half time, we went in Coventry 2, Charlton 1. And it got even better in the second half when Mr. Sims got another goal and made it 3-1. Wow, wow, wow. And one quick point about Ellis. He's a striker who'd lost his confidence at scoring. He's scored 5 goals in the past 3 matches. So, the match finished Coventry 3, Charlton 1. We have 43 points compared to second place Middlesbrough, who have 33. And we have a goal difference of plus 32 compared to Middlesbrough's 5. Oh yeah, and we're top of the league. Now, we are picking up quite a few injuries. I mean, Hadji Wright returned from playing for America with a leg injury. And we've just heard that Brandon Thomas Asante is out for at least 6 weeks with a hamstring injury. And Tak Sakamoto missed yesterday's match with concussion or the effects of. But it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, Brandon Thomas Asante was only playing because Ridoni was injured. And it was great to see Jack Ridoni back yesterday. In fact, he helped and was really responsible for Ellis Sims' 3rd goal after he'd sent it towards the net for it to be padded out by the goalie for Sims to smash. But, you know, we just better hope. Now, next Saturday we're travelling down to Ipswich, or across to Ipswich. I never was much good at geography. And that kickoff is at 3 p.m. And my smart speaker tells me we have another match the following Tuesday, that is the 9th, at 7:45 against one of our bogey teams, Preston North End. Though with Frank, we have no fear. And we did beat Preston last year. Now, moving to our lower league teams, well, technically classed as non-league, I'm afraid it's not looking good for our Leamington Town down in Tier 6, firmly rooted to the bottom of their league, ahead of their match with Worksop, which they then lost 2-0. Oh dear, Leamington still. Hopefully Santa will bring you some energy to change things round in the second half of the year. But it was better for Stratford, who played Bury St Edmunds and came back with a victory 2-1. Well done, Stratford. But I'm afraid it wasn't a good match for our Cov Rugby Club. They haven't actually had a very good season so far. And I'm afraid this continued in what was described as dismal conditions. I'm afraid they lost 24 points to 21 away to Doncaster Knights. And now moving on to wider nationwide and worldwide sport, I'm just going to talk about tennis for a bit. Yes, I know it's freezing cold out there and we don't do tennis in the winter, but in some parts of the world or indoors they do. So we have the absolute final of the ATP series recently, and that is for the top 12, I believe it is, men who play a round robin to start with, and then it's a straight semis and a straight final. Well, the battle continued, that being the battle between Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner. You may remember that Alcaraz beat Sinner in the French, then Sinner beat Alcaraz at Wimbledon, and then Alcaraz beat Sinner in America. Well, just to square the series, Sinner beat Alcaraz in this tournament. It's no wonder there's a headline on the BBC website currently that just says Sinner and Alcaraz are just the battles for 2026. Well, the F1 Grand Prix series staged its penultimate Grand Prix this weekend. In fact, I have literally 10 minutes ago just turned off the television from watching it, and I'm a bit breathless. So here goes. Now, this Grand Prix was in Qatar. On our time, it started at 4 p.m, but in their time, it was 7 p.m, so it was more of an evening night race. I actually found it quite confusing to watch because all of the cars had to do two compulsory stops for tyre changes. I don't know if it was the heat, the surface or what, but that was something insisted on by the tyre engineers. So you got people coming in, people going out, etc., etc., the whole time. Plus, to me, the lap seemed relatively short because the race itself took 57 laps but was all over in about an hour and 20 minutes. Anyway, you might remember as well, going into this Grand Prix, our Lando Norris could win the title, but equally in contention were also his teammate Oscar Piastri and Max Verstappen, who has held the title for 1,449 days. In other words, several years. Before I actually talk about the race, of particular note to me as a sort of observer was that at one stage George Russell nearly ran over a poor old car mechanic in the pit lane, but fortunately he missed. And secondly, and this is eye-watering, it took the team only 1.8 seconds of Oscar Piastri's car being stationary to have new tyres on. Incredible when you think, well, I used to take about an hour. Anyway, moving on. First of all, I must say, Oscar had a superb weekend. He won the sprint race and he was in pole position at the beginning. However, the final podium was first Max Verstappen, second Oscar Piastri, third Carlos Sainz, and fourth Lando Norris, who was very lucky to either overtake or be let through by one of his rivals, Kimi Antonelli, on the final lap, because that scored him another 2 points, which, with it being now so close, could be vital. So what does this mean for the title? Well, it still means that all of Oscar, Lando and Max could win the championship title. Lando still leads, but Max Verstappen is only 12 points behind now, with Oscar Piastri a further 4. If it's all a tie after the race, the number of wins is back counted, and they've all won 7 races. However, it would then go to the second place, and in that case, our Lando would win by a country mile. Now, the next Grand Prix, well, the last Grand Prix of the year, is in Abu Dhabi, and it's next Sunday, the 7th of December. And my smart speaker informs me it starts at 1 p.m. Oh, I need a break from all these Grand Prix. They're getting too crazy. And finally, just going to give you another date for your diary and leave you hanging in suspenders, although those of you who know me will know what it is. December the 18th, it's a Thursday, 7 p.m. and it's on BBC One. And all will be revealed next week. And that has been your sport. Do have a great weekend despite the cooler weather. And I'll hopefully speak to you next week. Bye.
Thanks, Sarah. And from sports, we go to Dave and this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag. I hope you're well. I hope the cold's not been getting to you, and I hope you're getting ready for Christmas. Are you going to any parties? Pantos, Christmas dinners, etc. Please start sending in your Christmas greetings as soon as you can so I can start compiling them for the special Christmas edition of Outlook. Now on Friday, December the 12th and Saturday the 13th, a procession of Christmas decorated tractors will be going through Warwickshire and Coventry, and going round Coventry on the Saturday evening. The main organiser will be Farmer Martin. The tractor will be decorated with Christmas lights and the minions from the cartoon films. Farmer Martin came to the Monday Club recently and parked his huge tractor in the car park, which brought back memories of working for Massey Ferguson for Elizabeth. Here she is with her latest report.
Hi, everyone. This week, coming into the hub, I got a distinct sense of déjà vu. There before me stood a trusty Fendt tractor, built in Germany. What a wonderful specimen. The pride of Massey Ferguson. Martin, an organic farmer, had brought her in to talk about farming today. What an interesting guy. This took me back to my working life, where I would enroll the guys from the Massey Ferguson dealers onto courses at the training centre at Stoneleigh. Instructors would educate them in the maintenance of their machines to a very high standard. Students would attend from all around the world, funded by the World Health Organization. There was a 50-bed residence at Stoneleigh, a bar, tennis courts and dining room. There was one very large field which would simulate the paddy fields of Indonesia. They would have to thrash their machines to the limits, bouncing them up and down. This was field test. My life at Stoneleigh was never boring. I met Simon Rhodes, who came for 3 months on various courses. His mother was closely attached to the Queen. Whilst he was staying at Stoneleigh, I organised a flight for him to attend a hunt ball at Balmoral. He lived in Rhodesia at the time. Simon was a lovely guy. During my Stoneleigh years, I met Colonel Gaddafi on several occasions. He would sweep in like a Shakespearean actor, wearing a black floor-length sandyman cloak. He had quite unusual, intense blue eyes. I would serve him coffee. He always came to specify the order of tractors bound for the Libyan Tractor Company. Gaddafi's tractors were always sent to Libya as CKD or PKD, completely knocked down or partly knocked down. They were then assembled in Libya. The annual Christmas lunch at Stoneleigh was legendary. A guy in MIS, Tony Hoffman, always gave a speech. He likened Stoneleigh to a public school, such as rugby. Everyone would end up in fits of laughter at the comings and goings of the past year. I.e., one guy had an accident at the Smithfield show. He broke his ankle. He was treated dexterously by one nurse in particular, whose car was still to be seen in Stairton, outside his property several months later.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Martin has a farm in Alton Farm in Ousley. He farms about 1,000 acres. He was opening and shutting the gate to let the sheep in and out while he was at the Monday Club, thanks to his smartwatch. Robert Franklin recommends you listen to In Touch on Radio 4 on Tuesday evenings between 8:40 and 9 p.m. Robert says they put it on Rugby Talking newspaper and suggests that it could be on Outlook. It's a programme presented by Peter White and it's for blind and visually impaired people. Thank you, Robert. So, how do you feel about In Touch being on Outlook? It's certainly a very helpful programme. One thing I heard on the repeat of In Touch early on the Sunday morning, about 6 o'clock I think, was an interview about R&IB starting to outsource transcribing Braille music to organisations not as experienced as they are. Graham has some information about a new development in Braille.
Dave mentioned having music transcribed into Braille. The Braille Library, certainly literature, I know had moved to a throwaway system a few years ago. They now, if you borrow a book now, or want to borrow a book from now, they provide it in a cheap format, put it in the post, and you can either keep it or throw it away. Up to you. But if you buy a copy of the same book, all they do is put it in fancy binding and charge you some extraordinary price. So you might as well just have it from the library and just throw it away, or keep it if you want to keep it. But I didn't know what happens regarding music until quite recently. I came across some music which I wanted to borrow in an old Braille music catalogue. When I come up to ring the library, I find that the Braille music, like the literature, has moved to a throwaway system. And not only that, because they don't have the music I want in a digital format on file, they cannot produce it for me in Braille. Now, you could probably apply that to most of the library's back stock. Now, the way the music library works, it's not like the literature section. It relies on people having music transcribed in the first place. If you have some music transcribed into Braille, it finds its way into the library. So somebody at some point must have already had that music transcribed into Braille. Now it seems if I want the same piece of music, I've got to go to the trouble of locating it and sending it off for transcription. You know, the RNIB make a lot of noises about encouraging people to use Braille in their public statements, but I do get a feeling that Braille is becoming a little bit of an embarrassment to them, and they wished it would go away.
Thank you, Graham. Tell us if you do Braille, or read talking books, or use Braille music. I did see an example of Moon somewhere recently. That's a system of reading for people whose fingers may not be as sensitive to reading Braille. The letters are larger than Braille and are similar to letters of the alphabet. Now, have you got broadband in your house? Jag Singh tells you that you can get cheaper broadband if you are on personal independence payment. Here's Jag Singh.
Hello everybody, it's Jag Singh here, and I hope you're keeping warm with this chilly weather that's here. A little tip for anybody who's claiming personal independent payments, or PIPs as it's known as. You can get cheaper broadband from Vodafone through their Essentials scheme. they call it a social tariff, but not many places will accept PIPs as a benefit, so to speak. But Vodafone do, and their broadband, although it's a kind of basic one, which suits me. I mean, I'm just about to transfer to it. It's £20 a month, which is a little bit of a saving. So if you're on their personal independent payments, you can sign in with Vodafone on their essential scheme social tariffs, and you can get £20 a month broadband. Well, I hope that helps, and I hope everybody's keeping well. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Jag, for another piece of helpful information. Do you struggle with all this technology? I keep trying to log on to things like trying to volunteer at the Charterhouse or top up my phone, but it doesn't recognise my username or my password. My username, as far as I'm concerned, is David Monks. That's the name I use. Do you have any ideas what a username is if it's not the one your parents gave you? Thank you for your messages this week, and please start sending in the Christmas greetings and Christmas jokes, Christmas songs, anything Christmassy. And just let your listeners, your fellow listeners, know they are not alone. And send in messages on any other subject as well. So, thank you. Please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
That's all there was in this post, in his postbag this time. Now, Elaine's joint takes her to Packington.
All the inhabitants love this part of the Forest of Arden, whether it be Great or Little Packington. The community existed long before the Norman Conquest, many Roman and Stone Age relics having been found. That it was of some prosperity is indicated by the existence of two mills, which served a local population of about 60. Its taxation value was 30 shillings, compared with the 20 shillings of its then humbler neighbour, Birmingham. The rural church is its focal point. Unfortunately, Little Packington Church became redundant, but has now been converted to a family dwelling. However, Great Packington Church still proudly looms large in people's lives. In 1278, the De Clintons of Maxstoke gave it to Kenilworth Priory, and thus it remained until the dissolution of the monasteries, which gave Henry VIII the opportunity to sell it for £626 to the sitting tenant John Fisher, who served with King Henry VIII, King Edward VI, Queen Mary, and Queen Elizabeth in court as gentlemen, pensioner to them all. A remarkable achievement in such troubled times. Subsequent generations of Fishers served as lords of the manor until 1712, when the second Earl of Aylesford married Mary Fisher. The present building is a strange-looking structure set in the middle of Packington Park. Its appearance belies the beauty of the interior, in which the eye is drawn to the altarpiece by Rigord, depicting the Ascension. The church is listed on two counts as historically and architecturally important, for in 1789, the building that the Fishers knew was demolished to make way for a brand new church by the fourth Earl of Aylesford, as a public thanksgiving for the recovery of George III from his mental illness. The building houses a chamber organ designed by Handel for his patron, Charles Jennens, who bequeathed it to his cousins, the Aylesfords. This forms the centrepiece of the annual concert by the choral and organ scholars of King's College, Cambridge. A curious feature in one of the cupolas is the Great Bell, Originally, there was a peal of three. But in 1805, the inhabitants, in their zealous excitement to celebrate the victory at Trafalgar, brought them crashing to the ground. They were melted down to form one great bell with a Latin inscription round its lip, recalling the mishap, together with a medallion of George III. There is no actual village in either parish. Great Pakington is indicated by no signpost, while Little Pakington infuriates all strangers who are baffled by the way the river bisects its 1,500 acres, across which its 14 houses are scattered. Here at the ford, formerly called Pakington Green, before the 18th century enclosures, the main road from Meriden, having passed through the deer park of Great Pakington, crossed on its way to Coleshill and Lichfield. Now there is only one footpath, and not many realise that the medieval due of 1 shilling is still handed over by the undertaker to the earl to permit the passage of a corpse to the churchyard, thus safeguarding the private ownership of the park, for the free passage of a dead body formerly created a right of way. Indications of former tenants abound in place names. We find Flint's Wood. He was a Catholic who was fined for refusing to go to the Anglican Church. Geary's Heath. There was a parson of that name. Dial's Pool. Mulliner's Rough. Butler's End. Todd's Rough. And Keatless Pool. Even more intriguing is Paddy's Path, along the line of an old footpath beside the main road, and Jones's Knob, both on rising ground opposite Rookwood, former home of the novelist George Eliot's brother, when he was land agent for the Aylesford's Pakington estate. 7 farms surround the 500-acre farm, and at the northern end lies a 400-acre landfill site, the largest in Europe, from which sand and gravel were formerly extracted, and which is now a Conservation Award winner. Old sand and gravel workings are transformed into a trout fishery and golf course on the eastern borders, also awarded a conservation prize. The Pakingtons today, in spite of being surrounded by a motorway and major trunk roads, continue to be an unspoilt rural community, owned by the 11th Earl of Aylesford. Following a fire at Pakington Hall in 1979, the Earl and Countess made the old hall their home, and since the death of the Countess, the Earl continues to reside there, while their heir, Lord Guernsey, and his family live at the hall. Both houses stand in the picturesque deer park, home of 400 rare black-backed fallow deer, roaming freely amongst the old meadow and several lakes.
And next week Elaine's going to Paleton. Local author Lee Child last week started talking to Gary Bushell of the Daily Express about his life. This week he explains how his hatred of injustice led to the creation of his well-loved character, Jack Reacher. Margaret's your reader.
Sacked after 18 years of service, Lee wrote Killing Floor at his dining room table, naming the villains after the managers who fired him. In his new Reacher book, The Stories Behind the Stories, he gives the background to the 24 novels he wrote solo. The 25th was his first collaboration with Andrew Child, youngest of his 3 brothers, and 4 more have followed. Unusually, rather than plan his plots in advance, he works around key points, making up the story as he goes, much like Miles Davis's modal jazz. Yes, I'm improvising line by line, which really suits me. As a reader, I love the feeling that you can't wait for what happens next. If I'd known exactly where the story was going, it'd be boring. He recalls reading Ovid's tale about Theseus and the Minotaur at school and reading Dr. No on the bus home. It was the same story in every detail. That's when I realised there aren't that many plots, so it's all about suspense and characters. He said he didn't actually think about how a book is constructed until he read a John D. MacDonald thriller at an airport in 1988. I could see what he was doing and why. I could see the blueprint. It was an epiphany. Lee's accent is as mangled as a villain's kneecap after it has collided with the reach of boot. My accent was always screwed up. My tax collector dad was from Northern Ireland, my mum was a Geordie, and I lived in America for 30 years. They would have hated me sounding Brummy because they were so aspirational. Lee and his American wife Jane now live in the Lake District, stunning and unchanged, and closer to his beloved Aston Villa, where he now gets invited to the chairman's suite. Daughter Ruth is still in Manhattan. Lee relaxes by smoking weed, reading, and listening to music. He owns guitars, including several Fenders, Gibson Les Pauls, and a vintage Martin. I'm a terrible guitarist, but it's a classic boomer thing. In 2018, he recorded a Reacher album called Just the Clothes on My Back with Naked Blue duo Jen and Scott Smith. Lee received a CBE in 2019. As an egalitarian, he didn't bow. Reacher made the big screen in 2012 with a 2016 sequel. The two films grossed £279 million, with 5 foot 7 inches Tom Cruise playing the 6 foot 5 inches Jack. I enjoyed working with Tom, but physically he was wrong for the role. At 6 foot 3 inches, Alan Richardson is more convincing in Reacher, which has been running on Prime since 2022, with a fourth season commissioned. Watch out for Lee's cameos. It beats the movies. A movie is 90 minutes, and an Amazon series is 8 hours. You can tell the story better and develop the characters. You don't have to compress the action. Alan is a joy to work with, a fun guy, and he works like crazy. A spin-off series, Neagley, based on Francis Neagley, reaches Oppo in his US Army 110th MP Special Investigations Unit, is also coming. Revenge is a constant theme. I hate injustice. Most people are decent. Most people like to help, but sometimes they can't in the real world. Avenging Angel, Reacher can. Lee grew up believing in a better tomorrow and bemoans the death of the post-war consensus, blaming the poisonous aspects of social media and the rise of political spin. Now officially retired, he still appears at literary festivals. I go to make myself scared of the talent, he laughs, adding, men should read more women writers. Women are great storytellers. Look at Karen Slaughter. Child has turned down two offers to take over writing Bond books. The Fleming estate is very controlling, and why would I agree to a 50-50 split? Why would I accept that? He'd once planned to kill off Reacher after 21 books. Recruiting Andrew kept him alive, but fans have been lukewarm. Will he ever come out of retirement to write a new Reacher story? Never say never, he says tantalisingly. I appreciate taking a break.
Have you read any Jack Reacher books? Let us know in Postbag. Dogs, as many of you well know, are extraordinary animals which can be trained for all sorts of tasks. Sue reads the first part of an article by Joanne Whitehead of the I newspaper about how they can sniff out deadly diseases.
Meet Jody. Hailing from Oxfordshire, this affectionate yellow Labrador lives with Caroline, her foster parent. She adores a tummy rub and isn't fussy about who gives them to her. Jodie loves to play and sleep in equal measure and enjoys a toy parade during which she proudly shows off any toy she can find to whoever is present. At 7 years old, she's also already on her second career. Jodie previously worked in the field of Pseudomonas, an infection that affects the lungs, skin and blood, and now is in the middle of a 2-year training program to learn how to detect cancer. Dogs have long been an integral part of family life for many people in the UK. A 2024 report by the PDSA found that over a quarter, 28%, of Britons are dog owners. As well as providing a package of mental and physical health benefits, a July study found that owning a dog is associated with slower cognitive decline. Dogs also possess a unique ability, with the potential to have a profound impact on scientific endeavour and human health and mortality, an extraordinarily sensitive nose. Researchers found that a dog's nose has 100 to 350 million scent receptors, compared with a human's 5 to 6 million. In addition to their impressive olfactory receptor count, around 30% of their brain is dedicated to analysing odours, which might explain why efforts to prevent your dog stopping to sniff every lamppost, bush and wall on your daily stroll can feel futile. And it's this supersensitive organ that is proving invaluable in the field of disease prevention, from neurological conditions such as Parkinson's to diseases like cancer. Based in Milton Keynes, Medical Detection Dogs is a small charity doing big things. Established in 2008 by scientists Dr. Claire Guest, OBE, and Dr. John Church, the pair set out to prove that dogs were capable of detecting cancer, starting with the publication of a landmark study in the British Medical Journal in 2004, which found that dogs could detect bladder cancer simply by sniffing urine samples of affected patients. This followed years of evidence from people who reported that their pets were repeatedly sniffing at moles on their body, or acting unusually around certain body parts, only for it later to transpire that they had cancerous tumours or melanoma. In the early days, there was quite a bit of scepticism, Gemma Butlin, a spokesman for the charity, says. But we don't get that so much these days. Now, the research and development they undertake is studied around the world. Dogs' acute sense of smell has long been utilised in other sectors where they detect explosives, drugs, people and even truffles, but their talents have remarkable promise in the field of human health. By simply sniffing samples of urine, sweat and even breath, the pack of pooches employed by medical detection dogs can not only detect malaria, COVID-19, urinary tract and Pseudomonas infections, but diseases such as prostate, bladder and bowel cancer. For patients whose embarrassment about seeking help with these sensitive diseases may delay them from accessing advice and treatment, this is particularly pertinent, not least because the UK has one of the worst cancer survival rates in Europe due to late diagnosis. As well as sniffing out disease, the dogs the charity trains include medical alert assistance dogs, which support people with complex health conditions such as endocrine disorders, Addison's disease and severe allergies by alerting them of an impending life-threatening medical event. Dogs can be trained to identify minute odour changes emitted prior to an emergency, such as a seizure, enabling people to live with more independence and limit hospital admissions and 999 calls. So, how do they do it? And how long does it take for dogs to achieve what humans can't? Training takes between 6 to 8 months for disease detection dogs, with breeds such as Labradors and Spaniels overrepresented when it comes to sniffing out disease. They're born to sniff, it's in their makeup, says Butlin.
And next week, Sue tells us how they're training dogs for medical use. Elaine asks, why is it some television is so hard to watch nowadays? From deafening advertisements to mumbling actors and background music that's too loud, it doesn't seem to be the pleasure it used to be. Terry Taplin in Prima magazine wonders why programmes can be so difficult to watch.
Cast your mind back to ye old days. Let's call them the 1980s, shall we? A time when the whole family came together around the TV in the corner to watch their favourite soap, a movie, or the football. Back then, we made do with nothing more than the one TV remote that controlled the choice of channel and the volume. Job done. And the person who held that remote reigned supreme. Fast forward to today. And you are quite literally looking at a very different picture. And in my opinion, it's not a great one. Now, when I take up my viewing position, I have to allow at least 20 minutes prep time to navigate my options. It's like being head of mission control at NASA. In my house, I need 4 remotes. Just to launch my evening's viewing. One for Sky, one for Apple TV Plus, the TV's on-off controller, and a separate handheld device just for the soundbar. However, that's where all similarity to NASA ends. I bet its technicians aren't scrabbling around in the innards of the sofa looking for missing remotes. It beats me how they get there from one evening to the next. In this advanced technological age, why isn't there just one remote that can do it all? Actually, there probably is. But who can afford to update their TV equipment every 5 minutes? Certainly, what is essential to have to hand is the volume control. Sound levels vary drastically across different platforms, but adverts are always 100 decibels louder than anything else. Yes, I understand I'm being sold stuff, but there's no need to burst my eardrums in the process. Shouting is never going to induce me to buy anything. And Netflix? Can we talk about that unnecessarily loud and extremely irritating ta-dum sound we get each time we tune in? It never fails to make me and the cats jump out of our skins every time. Let me give you some feedback, Netflix. Let's say ta-ta to the ta-dum right now. When I was younger, we had a Sony Triniton TV with a tiny 21-inch screen, but a remarkably good built-in sound system stored in the 20 inches built onto the back. I'm all for progress, but today's wafer-thin, giant-screened and mostly wall-mounted televisions generally don't have integrated speakers, hence the necessity for a soundbar. Yet even the highest quality soundbar won't solve the problem of mumbling. No amount of volume tweaking can make the dialogue on many shows understandable. There's nothing wrong with my hearing, but the muttering means that I have to resort to subtitles. Very distracting, considering I'm watching Happy Valley, Game of Thrones, Peaky Blinders, Wolf Hall, or anything starring Tom Hardy, the biggest mumbler in the TV jungle, rather than a French art house movie. As a side note, I was incensed to discover that much of that mumbling is deliberately filmed that way.
It's a choice, say directors, to make scenes sound more realistic. What's the point of realism if no one can understand what's being said? But it's not just those of us who are baby boomers or Generation X using subtitles. Today's 20-somethings and teens wouldn't dream of tuning in without them. Not because there's anything wrong with their young hearing either. It's so that they can stay glued to their mobiles and watch TV and TikTok at the same time. That's a new level of multitasking, but one I won't be troubling myself with. Now, where are those pesky remotes?
So do you have a favourite gripe of what's wrong with TV? Let us know again in post-play. Not long now till Christmas, and you may have seen this huge tractor recently parked here at the Vision Hub in the car park. Dave spoke to Farmer Martin before his talk to the Monday Club about the tractor parade he'll be taking around Coventry and Warwickshire on the 12th and 13th of December.
I'm speaking to you outside the resource centre. I'm speaking to a farmer now called Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello there,
and
David.
Now, you brought along your tractor, and it's huge, and it's in the resource centre car park. Fits in nicely, doesn't it? No problem.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Yeah, just in between some cars.
Well, how big is it? It's massive.
It is. It's 300 horsepower.
Yeah.
And it's about, 4 metres long and about 2.5-3 metres tall.
Yeah, great. And the tyres are huge, aren't they?
They are, yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what the tyre pressures are, really?
Yeah, the tyre pressures are... So this has got adjustable tyre pressures. So there's a pipe that goes there and then it runs down the centre of the hub.
Yeah.
And in the screen in the tractor, you can tell it what tyre pressure you want.
Oh, right.
So you can adjust it so you can have it harder on the road and softer in the field. So at the moment they've got about 30 PSI in them.
Right.
And then in the field you can have them running down at 10.
Oh, right, okay.
So how much are the tyres each?
Anywhere from 2,000-3,000 up to 5,000-6,000 a tyre.
That's each tyre?
Each tyre, yeah.
It is fantastic. They've got thick treads, haven't they?
Yes. You could roughly a tyre probably does about 2,000 working hours.
Yeah.
So, hopefully it'll last a couple of 3 years.
Yeah. So, what do you use it for on the farm?
Oh, cultivations, getting grass in for the cows, anything and everything really. Ploughing, moving grain around when we're combining. So lots and lots and lots of different things.
Does the combine, do you pull the combine harvester or is that under its own steam?
It's under its own steam, so this pulls a trailer that the combine harvester empties it into. It.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's quite a climb into the cab, isn't it?
It is.
Is there four steps or something?
Yeah, 4 steps and then it's got basically... 2/3 iPads in the cab which control everything.
Really?
Yeah, wow, yeah. So if you want, do you want to have a look in?
I thought you'd never ask. Right, let's get up into the cab. Gee whiz. Right. All we got to do now is just plough through the resource centre there. Coventry Vision Hub. We're right in front of Boston Lodge, yeah. Here we are. Oh, that's it. It's quiet, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I haven't started it, the actual engine. I've just turned the ignition on for you.
Ignition, yes. We've got two computer screens here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And an assortment of loads of different buttons.
And here they got coloured lights.
So it's just like an iPad. You just slide it to see different things, and you can adjust the tyre pressures. That's what we were talking about outside.
Yeah.
So you can set the tyre pressures to whatever you want.
Yes. Okay. Tell me about the Christmas lights parade. It's going to Coventry Street in Warwickshire.
Yeah.
Did you start that?
Yeah, so between me and the Sheepy Committee, yeah, we...
Sheepy Committee?
Yeah. Yeah, there's about 10 or 15 of us, and it's... we chatted one day, and we were like, oh, we should do this, and dress some tractors up with Christmas lights, and, it's great. So we go around North Warwickshire... on the Friday, and then we come down into Coventry, Bedworth and Nuneaton on the Saturday evening, so it's 12th and 13th of December.
Fantastic.
And we're driving for about four hours each day, something like that. It's amazing because we got about 60 to 80 tractors all dressed up with Christmas lights.
Wonderful. So what do you raise money for?
So raise money for Birmingham Children's Hospital, Warwickshire Air Ambulance, and a bit of an organisation called Lens Light, which then goes to mental health support within agriculture.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Martin, for coming along and bringing your tractor. I mean, I asked you to bring something. I was thinking about jars of honey or something, but you brought your tractor, which is amazing. Thank you.
You are welcome.
I've got Elizabeth. Elizabeth here. Now, you used to work for Massey Ferguson, didn't you?
30 blooming years. Between Stoneleigh and... I used to have all the coming in from the dealers on courses over at Stoneleigh.
Yeah. They still do.
So what do you think of the big huge tractor in the car park? Can you see it?
It takes you back to old time. When they launched the drop nose one, I literally had tears in my eyes. The launch was so nice. It appeared in Stoneleigh out of a cloud of smoke, and I actually had tears in my eyes. It was a brilliant launch.
Yes.
When they launched the drop nose, before your time.
Yeah.
Can you remember?
Yeah.
Oh, he knows me tractors. Oh, can I have a look? No.
Yeah, of course you can.
Oh, it is. It's a fence. That German, yeah. How nice.
And it's got St. George's flag waving to the top.
Yeah, how nice. Oh, that takes me back.
Okay, thanks a lot, Martin. While you've been at the Monday Club, you've been opening and shutting gates on the farm, have you?
Yes, letting sheep in and out to come and graze the ground while I'm not there.
How did you do that?
Just used my phone. I did it on my watch because it's linked to the gate, so I can just call the gate and it opens.
So how do you know it was time for the sheep to go through the gates?
Oh, someone rang me a couple of times, and then it stopped, and then I knew that when they stop, it needs opening. hence, I'm having another phone call now.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for coming to the Monday Club with your big, huge tractor. It's been really exciting. Thank you. Interesting.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
And congratulations to Martin for being awarded the CWR Make a Difference Award for his fundraising. Now, just before we go, Sarah's back with her answers to the sports quiz she set you last week.
And here are the answers to the sports quiz that I set you last week. Which team plays at the Emirates? It's the mighty Gunners, Arsenal. Leicester City play at the King Power. Question 3. The 2025 Open Golf this year was played at Port Rush in Northern Ireland. Sheffield Wednesday play at Hillsborough. The US Open Tennis is played at Flushing Meadows. Plymouth Argyle's home ground is called Home Park. Yeah, I know it's a little bit uninspiring, but that's what it's called. Where do Harlequins Rugby Football Club play their home games? Twickers, my dear. Twickenham also known now by its sponsor's name, the Alliance Stadium. Who plays at the Oval? Surrey County Cricket Club. There endeth my cricket knowledge. The French Open tennis is held at the Roland Garros. And the famous team competition that was played at Farmingdale, New York State, was the Ryder Cup. Question 11. The glorified Winter Duck Pond, the ground where Worcestershire play their matches that is infamous for flooding, is New Road. I think they need some new draining. Who plays at the Keep Moat? Doncaster Rovers. I love that question, but I did once go to the Keep Moat and it is a lovely little stadium. Meanwhile, question 13, Burnley's home ground is called Turf Moor and apparently it is very cold and very high. Question 14, the ground of which Premier League football club is named after a credit card? Brighton and Hove Albion, of course, the Amex. American Express, the Amex, like it? And finally, the one that I hope you all got right, the Hallow Turf, formerly called the Rico Arena, is now called the Coventry Building Society Arena, where great things happen to Coventry City. Seriously though, I hope you've had a bit of fun with my quiz. Bye.
So how did you get on? I was a miserable failure. And that's the end of this week's Outlook. So from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team, it's goodbye till next week. And don't forget to get your Christmas messages in very quickly.